Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. This hour, universities are updating policies in response to campus protests over the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, adding to concerns about free speech and the health of our democracy in advance of November's election. So could stronger civic education in our schools and universities promote constructive dialogue and uphold the democratic values critical for a functioning republic? We'll find out tonight. And we'll also hear from Sean Dorsey, the transgender choreographer and founder of the Sean Dorsey Dance Company. But first, as artificial intelligence continues to advance, so too do the ethical and legal challenges that it presents. One alarming development has been the rise of AI-generated deepfake pornography, which has become a growing threat to both privacy and consent. This month, the San Francisco City Attorney's Office filed a lawsuit against several websites that host and create non-consensual deepfake porn, aiming to hold them accountable for the harm they cause. And tonight, we'll explore the details of this groundbreaking legal action and its potential impact on the fight against digital exploitation with San Francisco Chief Deputy City Attorney Yvonne Mede. Yvonne, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much, Ethan. Really happy to be here.
So, Yvonne, let's start by just explaining, what are deepfake nudes and where are they coming from?
Sure. Deepfake nudes are photos of, in part, a real person, generally the face of a real person, that then are ingested into a website that undresses the person in the photo, creating a pornographic image.
Generally, so it's all done through artificial intelligence.
Correct. And these images are generated without the consent of the people depicted in the photos and are nearly indistinguishable from real photos. When you see them, you cannot tell that the image before you is something that is AI generated.
And so what inspired you and your office to take action against these websites? What was the impetus behind the lawsuit that you're filing?
So first, our office files cases on behalf sometimes of the city and sometimes of the people of the state of California to protect consumers. We have tools under state law that allow us to do that. But this case in particular came out of me reading the newspaper. So it was in March. I was reading an article in the newspaper about a 15-year-old girl who had AI-generated, non-consensual, pornographic images created of her. And the article not only described like the pain and the sense of violation and the humiliation that those images wrought on her life, but it was also equally about her mom's profound exasperation that she couldn't help her daughter, she couldn't hold the people who had created these images responsible, and she couldn't stem the harm her daughter was facing. So I was horrified, honestly, and super frustrated. I had at the time a 15-year-old daughter, and I couldn't imagine what it would feel like if her autonomy was stripped from her in that way, you know, and her image used in this kind of public non-consensual way. So, and as a lawyer, I also found it horrifying, and I couldn't believe that there was no consequence to this kind of business practice. And so that frustration and anger caused me to reach out to the city attorney. And then we put together a team in the office and that started investigating these actors and in this space. But it all honestly came from reporters who reported a story that I thought was really unfair. And as one of my colleagues, Sarah Eisenberg, said, I followed my anger and we put a team together to look at it.
Well, it's a great example of journalism combined with activism, having someone like you in a position to act on what you're reading about. Let me ask you a little bit more about this general issue. How widespread is non-consensual deepfake pornography? I mean, how many people are visiting these sites? How often does this seem to be happening?
So I can't confess to have a perfect answer to that question, but I'll say that there is a proliferation of these images of women and girls It happens all over the country and all over the world. We, in the websites that we looked at collectively, the 16 websites had been visited 200 million times just in the first 6 months of 2024. So the volume is enormous. And it is a phenomenon that is affecting everyone from, you know, the 15-year-old high school kid in the article to famous celebrities that are seeing their images used in this pornographic, unlawful mm-hmm. way.
And are there any repercussions right now for these websites allowing this kind of deepfake generated imagery to proliferate?
Well, there are state laws and there are federal laws that ban deepfake pornography. I think the problem is a practical one, which is that you can't tell where an image comes from. And so there have been lawsuits that have challenged individuals who would take these photos and ingest them into a website, but the websites themselves have evaded consequence. And so we are hoping that our lawsuit is one of many tactics that will hold these companies responsible for and accountable to what they're doing.
Yeah, so let's talk about your lawsuit. What's the legal basis for it, and how is this different or additive to the existing laws that presumably should be enforced against these companies here?
Sure. So the umbrella over our lawsuit is something called the Unfair Competition Law. It's a California law that says that any business act or practice that is unfair, unlawful, fraudulent, or deceptive in its advertising is an act of unfair competition. And the California legislature vests public law offices with the ability to enforce that law, ours being the San Francisco City Attorney being one of them. And so the laws that we have underlying federal and state law, what we call predicates, they are laws that are violating that we are using as predicate acts of unfair competition. So state laws banning deep fake pornography that may have a criminal penalty, we can use that law and import it into the UCL and hold companies accountable for those acts civilly.
Well, so along those lines, what would the remedy be if you're successful with the lawsuit, both in terms of the website creators and for the victims?
So we're hoping to shut down the websites. So we're suing for what's called injunctive relief, which is a court order that would do us something. Here, we're hoping that the websites get shut down. There also is a provision of monetary penalties, but the impetus of this case is to stop the pernicious practice that is existing.
Yeah, I did want to hear about the victims, but just real quick on this point about the companies. So are these companies that this is sort of their only business model, or are there some AI websites where this is just an aspect of what's happening with their product, and therefore maybe you don't want to shut down the whole website, but just this aspect of what they're doing?
So the companies that we targeted are companies that this is their main business. Mm-hmm. They create deepfake nudes.
Thank you for explaining that. I appreciate that. And then you're about to talk about the victims, so I did want to give you a chance to talk about what the upside would be for the victims beyond, obviously, not creating new victims, but for the people who have already been victimized.
Sure. I mean, part of it is we don't sue on behalf of victims directly. So we are suing on behalf of the state, and so, or the people of the state of California. So I think indirectly, you're right, Ethan, that one of the hopes is in shutting down the websites, it will stop the bleeding, right? It will stop additional victims from being created. I also think that there is a national and an international dialogue here about how governments and how good corporate actors can ensure that these kinds of tools that have all sorts of benefits are not used for an unlawful means.
And is that maybe part of the end game here, that if California can take action as you're doing through this lawsuit, that this can then motivate national, maybe even, as you say, international action against these websites?
I mean, I think it adds to the dialogue that is existing. Yes. And we're hoping that it also exposes people to a practice that I don't think we're all aware of, but is really awful. It's awful.
And then, And then what about this sort of dynamic of whack-a-mole that you might shut down a few websites, but it's hard to control what comes out on the internet? Are there any examples of where we've been able to shut down websites that are doing illegal things in a systematic way, or is it just a constant game of whack-a-mole?
Well, I think, you know, we did not grab every company that is doing this right now. We grabbed some of the largest. And so our hope is through litigation like this that has real consequences, that we will deter others from continuing businesses in this way. It is part of what is really important to that end is showing that there are meaningful consequences and to just get the word out about these lawsuits, because we have not grabbed the entire universe of this business.
I also want to ask you about jurisdiction, because I imagine some of these owners and creators of these websites are not located in California. What kind of reach could the state have over a website that's, you know, coming from some country far, far across the globe?
It's a great question. It's one of the challenges that we will have. We certainly have companies that are doing business in the United States. We have companies that are doing business abroad in the UK and other countries, and some honestly that we're not even sure yet. But I think part of what we think is important in this lawsuit is that these companies are availing themselves of California consumers. They're doing these activities that are hurting Californians. They should be answerable to California courts. Now, whether or not that is something that we achieve in this litigation or on appeal or in another case, we think that the issue was important enough and ripe enough to take the risk.
And what are the next steps in the lawsuit? What can the public expect to happen now that this this litigation has been filed?
So the next steps are we have to serve the 16 defendants, and then they need to respond. And they need to respond either by answering the allegations to the complaint or making some kind of motion to challenge our complaint and our theories.
So we'll stay tuned then for how this plays out. Just about a minute left here or so. Just if you could wave a magic wand in terms of how this lawsuit would help advance solutions on this issue, what would you like to see happen at the state or national or even international level, as you referenced earlier?
Yes, what I would like to see is that different agencies and bodies who have jurisdiction over a portion of this, those who enforce criminal laws, those who legislate reforms, right? Right now, there's a measure pending in Congress called the Defiance Act, which is germane to the issues that we are litigating. I'd like everyone to take the power that they have through the lens that they see the world and do their work and do something to stop this practice. It's not right that women and girls are afraid of sharing their images for fear that they're not a non-consensual pornographic result will kind of destroy their lives. We can't do this to the women and girls, and we have to fight. No one entity is going to fix this, but I think if we work together through our individual lenses and the individual power that we have, I'm hoping the world is a little bit different at the end.
Well, Yvonne Mede, San Francisco Chief Deputy City Attorney, thank you so much for coming on State of the Bay, explaining this lawsuit, and more importantly, for your activism. You're using your platform to help advance justice and solutions on this really disturbing and important issue. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Ethan. Thanks for having us on.
And coming up next, we're going to explore how civic education can play a pivotal role in fostering constructive dialogue and maintaining democratic principles on our campuses and beyond. So stay with us.
Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. for an ongoing series on Project 2025. This Heritage Foundation-led plan lays out an agenda to transform the country into a Christian nation. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. here on KALW.
This week on The Arts, you'll hear about Dan Hoyle's latest one-man show, Takes All Kinds. His director, Aldo Billingsley, will also be on hand. Philippa Kelly talks with the creatives presenting a new interpretation of Shakespeare's Richard II, being presented by the Magic Theater and Play on Shakespeare. And Peter Robinson gives us some background on Noel Coward's Private Lives, being presented next month at ACT at the Tony Rumby Theater. I'm David LaTulipe. Join me on The Arts Wednesday at 4.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. As college students return to campuses around the country this month, coming up in the next few weeks, schools across the U.S. are preparing for a resurgence of campus protests and possible violence surrounding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And just last week, the University of California, as well as the California State University Systems, announced updates to their policies on campus protests, yet another illustration of the growing tension in and around our educational institutions. So in a politically divided nation, these campus conflicts, which are too often replete with physical altercations, people shouting each other down, they reinforce crucial questions about the health of our democracy. And they've led some scholars and organizations to advocate for a recentering of civic education in our schools. They claim that civics, which includes social studies, U.S. history, and government, will help to equip students to manage these challenging times, as well as the debates that animate them. So tonight, we're going to explore the critical role that civic education, both in our K through 12 schools and at the college level, plays in fostering constructive dialogue and upholding democratic principles on our campuses and beyond. And we're very pleased to be joined by Dan Edelstein, Faculty Director of the Civic, Liberal, and Global Education Program at Stanford University. So welcome, Dan.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me tonight.
And we're also joined by Emma Humphreys, Chief Education Officer at iCivics, a nonpartisan organization dedicated to providing high-quality, equitable civic education opportunities for each new generation. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And for State of the Bay listeners, we're going to open up the phone lines early tonight to hear from you. Did you take civics when you were in school? How did social studies, U.S. history, and government classes influence your view of the United States or your perspective on what it means to be a productive citizen? You can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Dan, let me start with you. If you could just set the stage for us. What was it like this past year on Stanford's campus, specifically where you work?
I think what was kind of uncanny at Stanford was seeing how it felt like all universities were kind of facing this sort of similar scenario because it was, we also had an encampment. We had obviously a lot of tension between students who were my dog gets very animated when I speak about this. I
just the dog's a fan of State of the Bay.
Yes, we could all learn something from how our animals communicate. But I think nobody was happy is how I would summarize it. That everybody felt that this was not a good way either to have our people's voices heard, to have any kind of dialogue about the issues. And I think that also we realized that the university's policies were perhaps not well understood, not well always implemented in a consistent fashion, which is a sort of a problem that we saw across the country. Mm-hmm. I think we avoided any real escalation. We did not bring in the police to empty an encampment when it was occupied, and I think our provost and president did a really great job with a very difficult situation. But I think all of us right now are thinking, okay, what can we do to try to avoid this situation moving forward?
Well, and Dan, you've been at Stanford for 20 years now, as I understand it. Have you observed changes in how the student body understands and respects free speech, social engagement, and basic expressions of democratic principles?
I think what I find most striking today is, I think there's a plus and perhaps a negative. The plus is that our students are really aware of what's going on in the world. I think to an extent that they were less 10, 15 years ago. So, we weren't talking much about student activism when I got to Stanford, but I think it was true pretty much nationwide. There was much less of it than, say, 20 years earlier. So our students are more aware, they're more engaged. I think what's changed, though, is that they're getting their information from different sources. sources that are not our sort of traditional media, but sources where they tend to get information and interpretation all bundled together. So it's not just this thing happened, it's this horrible thing happened and you should be really upset about it. And so I fear that sometimes it kind of short circuits the opportunity to have some critical thinking, to ask, okay, is that the full story? Is there something else going on as well? And of course, it leads to, you know, very strong emotional and passionate responses on the part of our students. And I'm not saying that this passion is misguided. I think what made last year so incredibly difficult was that it was a gut-wrenching situation, and people just felt really horrible about what was going on. But I think the other thing that perhaps has changed, so when I teach, we teach free speech in this program that you were describing, the college program, Civic Liberal Global Education. And one of the things I find really interesting is our students' attitudes towards hate speech. One thing that I've noticed, and I'm not really sure how much this has changed because we haven't been teaching this class for that long, but when we present the sort of traditional John Stuart Mill view about harm speech and under what conditions Mill thought that some speech should be censored or crosses a criminal line, like, you know, the famous example of screaming fire in a crowded theater, our students actually always kind of want that line to be a bit farther down. They want psychological harm to be also considered just as harmful as physical harm. And I find that very interesting because it does suggest that our modern sensibilities around speech are somewhat at odds with our legal structure for speech, you know. And it should be pointed out that, you know, the US is quite an exception here. Almost every European democracy does criminalize hate speech. We're kind of the odd ones out. And so we found that, like, talking about that with students is very helpful. Like, you know, we can tell them, look, like, we don't make the rules. Like, this is how it is. There's a reason why. I mean, it gets complicated when you want to criminalize hate speech. That's not a perfect system either. But this one also has these problems.
Well, this points to potentially the argument in favor of broader civic education. And I want to turn to Emma Humphreys at iCivics. And Emma, can you just describe a bit about what the traditional goals and components of a civic education involve? What is civic education for those not familiar?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that and to do it with a nod to iCivics founder and the first female Supreme Court Justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, who often said that knowledge about democracy is not passed down through the gene pool. We must teach it to each and every generation. And that's the purpose of civic education. Those are the traditional goals and components of civic education, to teach the knowledge, the skills, and dispositions of citizenship so that individuals may understand, pay attention to, and participate in our democratic republic. So in that very traditional sense, we think back to those civics textbooks. It's about knowing all the information, knowing about how our system works, knowing what to do with that information, having the skills to actually participate, and then having those dispositions, right, to care, to want to participate, to care about your community and the common good.
And Emma, my understanding is that the focus of K-12 schooling, it's been a long time since I was in K-12, has moved away from this kind of civic education. And I know that in 2023, University of California, Riverside published a report showing that California public schools are, in fact, weak in civic education. Can you explain what's happened in our K-12 schooling as well as at our university level here in California to move away from civics?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I used to be a classroom history teacher, a high school history teacher. So I'll do a little history lesson, but try not to bore your listeners with a 40-minute lecture. But, you know, here's the gist. If you were in high school in the United States in the 1960s, up until the 1960s, you probably received up to 3 courses in civics and government. But then something changed. And that something that changed was our national sense of confidence and security. And in 1957, the U.S. was locked in a tense Cold War, a feverish space race with the Soviet Union. The Soviets launched satellite Sputnik, and they scared the civics right out of us. They beat us into orbit, and we felt this nationwide sense of vulnerability. And for the next 6 decades, civic education has increasingly taken a backseat to science, technology, and engineering, math via the National Defensive Education Act, a Nation at Risk report, and later to reading and language arts in the wake of No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top. And just to be clear, this trend has absolutely transcended political party and administrations. There's no pointing the partisan finger here. We've all sort of been to blame. So fast forward to today, over 60 years from that fateful day in 1957, when Americans could literally stand out in their front lawns and see the enemy's technological advancement flying above overhead. And we're teaching civics less and less at a time when our democracy seems weaker and weaker. And to put some numbers behind it, you know, we spend 13 years from kindergarten to 12th grade teaching kids how to read and write and do math. And then we spend just about one semester in 12th grade teaching them how to be citizens, which, by the way, is the very purpose of the founding of the great American school system. And so there's a reason we are where we are today. We've been doing this for decades. It's been a slow, sure trend in the wrong direction. And I think we're all seeing the effects across our democratic republic. It took us a long time to get here. So the bad news is it'll take us some time, right? This is the long game to build our way out of it. But we know that civic education is absolutely the long-term solution to maintaining our republic.
And so, Emma, if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like this is a national problem, or is California maybe an outlier here, or are we kind of within the norm of most states and where we are in terms of teaching civics?
Yeah, I'm sad to say you're in the norm. I mean, there are some some exceptions, right? There are some states that have really prioritized civic education. But across the board, civics is underprioritized, underfunded, decreased instructional time, particularly relative to English language arts and math. But to be fair, California is doing some things right when it comes to civics. And I would be remiss in not mentioning that California has a seal of civic engagement program for high school diplomas. There are some school districts in California that offer credit for service learning, which is one of those best practices in civics. There's a model school library standards, a set of model school library standards that bring in media and information literacy skills. So there are some good things happening, but California has yet to require a standalone middle school civics course or to mandate that civics instructional time is increased at the elementary level. So still a lot of work to be done there on the policy front.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the specifics of what could be done. We can get into that in just a little bit. I want to let listeners know, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the importance of civic education for the health of our democracy. Very pleased to be joined by Dan Edelstein, Faculty Director of the Civic, Liberal, and Global Education Program at Stanford University, and Emma Humphreys, Chief Education Officer at iCivics. And we would love to hear from you as well, our listeners. Do you believe a decline in civic education has contributed to a weaker democracy? And if so, how do you think a stronger emphasis on civics in our schools could change the way citizens, students engage with politics in their communities? You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or leave us a comment on social media. We have an email in from Ron in Berkeley who writes, I remember learning about the branches of government and the Constitution in school, but not much about how to engage in civil discourse. How can we teach students to have productive political conversations? And Dan, let me direct that question to you. How do you see the connection between teaching civics and these debates like what we're seeing in these protests and conflicts that we're seeing over issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict raging right now?
I think it's a great question. And I think it's also the case that while we need everyone to have a certain degree of what I guess we could call civic literacy, you know, understanding how the government works, I think the real crisis right now is more in the area of sort of civic engagement and how do we talk to each other? How do we even accept people who have different points of view than us? I think that's perhaps what we need to work on sort of in the most emergency fashion right now, that we have become so polarized as a nation that people with different points of view often appear illegitimate in many eyes. And so people don't see the point of even listening to them. And it's really hard to imagine having a functioning democracy if that's the case, that you can't listen to someone even if you fundamentally disagree with them, but still accept that there are going to be people who think differently than you. So in our class, we actually spend very little time on, you know, I guess the more traditional contents of a civics class, and much more on trying to work on what are the skills we need for citizenship, not just the knowledge, but what does it mean to really listen to somebody that you disagree with? What's the difference between deliberation and debate? How might you try to understand someone, even if you're not trying to, you know, even if you disagree with them and you really don't think there's any chance they'll convince you, but still understand why they think that. So it's kind of more at the cognitive level that we're really focused.
And Dan, has civics education at the college level, in your observation about it, evolved over the years? Is it different now than, say, 20 years ago when you started at Stanford?
Well, it's interesting. I was fascinated to hear Emma's sort of short history of civic education in the high school level, because I think there's a very similar story that happened in higher education, that, you know, up until the 1980s across most of the country, there were these sort of big Western civ programs that were pretty common. Stanford had one as well. And even though the focus of those programs was more on, you know, great books, as it were, there was a kind of civic element to them. Actually, both at Stanford and at Columbia, when these programs were first founded, it was much more explicitly about citizenship. And I think that lingered a bit. But then, you know, for various reasons, and many of them good, those programs were largely dismantled in the 1980s. But they weren't replaced with anything that filled that role. And so just like in Emma's story, sort of about the reaction to Sputnik, in a kind of delayed way, I think the reaction to the loss of these Western Civ programs was just to focus on, you know, STEM and other, you know, more what was seen as more practical things. But the problem is that civics is a public good. And if we don't mandate it, there are very few private incentives for individuals to become a good citizen, right? It's not something that if I decide, okay, I personally am going to be a good citizen, that's not really going to solve anything. We need this to be a collective action where we are deciding that it is good for all of us that our students do this. Mm-hmm. And that's a political decision.
That's, yeah, it's a systemic change, really, ultimately, or cultural change. Emma, I wanted to give you a chance to, first of all, respond to Ron's emailed question, but also just to maybe to describe in your view what other reasons you believe a well-rounded education in civics is, why it's so important to have that in terms of the health of our democracy, and how that would play out with these specific conflicts like the Israeli-Palestinian ones.
Yeah, sure. You know, when I started my career as a civics high school and government teacher 20 years ago, I would have told you that students need first and foremost that basic knowledge of our system of government, the institutions, the structures, the principles, and how it all works. And today I think that sort of civics 101 content is still really important, but not nearly as much as those skills and those dispositions. I think today more than anything, we need to teach our young people to care and how to care. And here's what I mean by that. I think we need young people to care about democracy, to care that they're being exposed to differing viewpoints, to want to be exposed to differing viewpoints, to care about having open and civil conversations across political difference, and to care if the information they're consuming and sharing is true. And they need to know how to do those things. I wasn't born knowing how to have a civil conversation with someone, or how to triangulate my reading and lateral reading and look for clickbait, right? These are things that you have to be taught to determine the veracity of a news source. And you learn these things at schools, right? In schools. Schools are the sort of laboratories of democracy, the same way you do a science experiment in your science class to learn about a chemical reaction. You have to have opportunities to talk to different people, to engage in dialogue, conversation with those with differing viewpoints. You have to have those opportunities. And mm-hmm. I think if we did that more, you know, we would find that adults were better able to handle a conflict as complex and horrifying as Israel and Palestine. You know, that folks are, could sort of look at something and say that two things can be true at once. And I can feel very passionately that I am right and still acknowledge that the person across from me feels just as certain that they're right and that person is still a good person and so am I. And if you don't have these opportunities to practice this in the classroom, in this safe place where your teachers are helping you make sense of it all, where are you going to get that practice? You know, at the dentist's office while you're watching 24-hour cable news, waiting for the doctor to come in. We've got to do this in schools, but unfortunately, we've made it really difficult for teachers to do that.
Well, Emma, that makes a lot of sense. At the same time, we're seeing this movement away from having schools be places where we discuss controversial issues. There's so-called divisive concepts legislation under consideration, state legislatures trying to kind of de-escalate these discussion topics. So how do we square what you're describing, which is important learning opportunities, with this other movement to try to remove these topics from conversation?
Gosh, I have no idea. I was hoping that you or Dan would come prepared. No, I think there's a couple of things that we suggest, you know, and one is the first thing is just this messaging out to the American public and to shift the mindset around this. So folks are expecting, demanding, encouraging controversial and current issues discussions to have in classrooms. And I'm always saying to parents, like, talk to your teachers, right? The other side of that is teacher training, so that teachers feel confidence in why they should be engaging in this best practice, and that they feel confident in their ability to facilitate these discussions, and that they feel safe because they've communicated with their administration and with their parents. And so one of my top messages to teachers is always, listen, the first time a parent finds out that you're teaching about a current and controversial issue isn't when the kid just comes home and says, yeah, today we talked about abortion. No, they should know about that because you sent home a paper letting them know that you were going to be covering these types of issues and explaining your goals. And similarly with your administration, the first time your principal finds out that you're teaching one of these controversial topics shouldn't be when a parent calls to complain and say, what the heck is going on in Mrs. Humphrey's class down the hall? So you got to communicate with folks ahead of time and look for that support from your colleagues and from your administration.
Well, we're talking to Dan Edelstein, Faculty Director of the Civic, Liberal, and Global Education Program at Stanford University, and Emma Humphreys, Chief Education Officer at iCivics. This is Ethan Elkind. You're listening to State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area, 91.7 FM. We're talking about the importance of civic education for the health of our democracy. We'd love to hear from you if you believe that these core topics covered in civic education for our students should be more widespread, then what skills and knowledges would be most crucial for young people to become better informed citizens? What questions you have for our panelists, you can join the conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we do have another email question from Blair in San Francisco, who writes, I've noticed that young people today seem less interested in voting or participating in politics. Do you think a stronger emphasis on civics education could help reverse this trend? And Dan, let me give you the first crack at that question.
Well, I actually think that our students are voting in pretty high numbers. There's been a lot of effort nationwide. There's a bunch of consortia that are really focused on getting out the vote. And I don't have the numbers at the tip of my fingertips, but I know that our local chapter called Stanford Votes had very high turnout in the last presidential election. And I think that's definitely one of the things we're also hoping will happen. Stanford recently even created a Democracy Day. So every second Tuesday in November, even if there's not an election, all classes are canceled precisely to either both give students the opportunity to vote, but also to have programming that is relevant to elections. So I think that's something we need to keep doing. But I agree with the second point that we need also to be valorizing public service more. And it's something we've also been talking about here, and I'm sure on other campuses as well. Encouraging students to look not just at, you know, the kind of public service that gets in the news, but that, you know, you want to make a big change in your community. I mean, run for local government. There's all sorts of ways you can get involved, and you know, perhaps being in local government can be where you can actually get changes done. And so I think that's maybe particularly tricky in this part of the country where a lot of our students are feeling just so concerned about, you know, financial considerations, but hopefully this excitement and the, mm-hmm. you know, the great energy that our students are bringing can also be channeled in that direction.
And Emma, we just have a couple minutes left here, but that does lead to the question of, you know, what are some of the best practices? What would you like to see done, you know, if folks who are interested in this issue, you know, whether it's in the people's local communities or, you know, at a broader state level or even national level?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to hear anyone talk about young people in elections without hearing the word apathy. I don't think that's fair. I think young people care a whole lot, and we've done a poor job of giving them things to care about and teaching them and showing them why they should care. So best practices in my field include inquiry-based learning, asking questions, allowing students to dig into primary sources and to investigate, and to have them do this with issues that are local and contextual and relevant to their lives. And if it comes down to an election, and if the kids in New York or Texas or California and saying it doesn't matter, you know, my state's always going to go blue or my state's always going to go red, well, then teach them about the down ballot races that have come down to 200 votes or about the mm-hmm. statewide ballot initiatives and referendum. But more than anything, give them opportunities to talk about current and controversial issues. It's not just a best practice. It is the best practice. And I would argue that our democracy depends upon our availability or our opportunity to teach young people how to do this and to provide them with opportunities to do so.
And Emma, just briefly, can you talk about the Educating for American Democracy initiative as part of this?
Yeah, Educating for American Democracy is a call to action to invest in strengthening history and civic learning to ensure that civic learning opportunities are delivered equitably throughout this country. It's about shifting the way we teach history and civics from breadth to depth, and it offers an inquiry framework that allows us to weave history and civics together and inspire students to learn by asking difficult questions and seeking answers in the classroom through facts and discussion. And it is a framework and it's a philosophy born of consensus, of plurality of viewpoints, over 300 people from across the political spectrum coming together to say, this is important. We can do this. We don't have to always let the culture wars get in the way.
And Dan, just briefly, last thoughts here. Any resources or best practices, examples you want to highlight for listeners, particularly for higher education like at Stanford?
Well, I think there is a movement underfoot right now. Lots of college presidents, lots of faculty are really concerned about this, have been reaching out. The Institute for Citizens and Scholars has been doing a great job in this area, the Teagle Foundation as well. And I think that it's actually an exciting moment in higher ed because it's not that often that you feel like you can sort of move the boat in another direction.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you kind of ending on this positive note. There's obviously so much more we could talk about, but we're out of time. And I just want to thank you both for coming on tonight. Dan Edelstein, Faculty Director of the Civic, Liberal, and Global Education Program at Stanford University. Thank you for joining us.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Emma Humphreys, Chief Education Officer at iCivics. Thank you for coming on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much.
And coming up after the break, we'll hear my interview with Emmy Award-winning choreographer Sean Dorsey. So stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. Every Monday, we start the week with our One Planet series, wide-ranging conversations about humanity and the environment. And on Fridays, we convene our media roundtable, where journalists analyze the week's news and highlight great reporting you might have missed. In between, we talk about things that matter, from the global to the local. Join us weekdays at 10 a.m. here on KALW, or subscribe to Your Call on iTunes or wherever else you find your podcasts.
So love back then was very special because it was so closeted.
Oh yes, I remember now her. You want to hear this one? She was beautiful.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind, and I'm excited to be joined by Sean Dorsey, an Emmy Award-winning choreographer who has truly opened up people's hearts and minds with his art. Sean is a dancer, writer, and cultural activist, and recognized as the country's first acclaimed transgender modern dance choreographer. Sean is celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Sean Dorsey Dance Company, and I'm excited to welcome Sean to our show tonight. So welcome to State of the Bay, Sean.
Thank you so much, Ethan. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Sean, let me first start by asking, how was it that you came to find dance? Has it always been something that's important to you?
Absolutely. My earliest memories, I remember spinning around my living room in my leotard. So moving, movement and dance have always been enormous sources of joy for me. So from my first memories, I was always dancing. Yeah.
And what's your approach to choreography? How would you describe your style?
Yeah, I think I start off by acknowledging that most of your listeners probably have a fairly universal response when they hear the words modern dance, which is, oh my God, you know, let me run in the other direction. Because so much modern dance tends to be quite abstract. So my work is the opposite of that. All of my work is rooted in human stories. I work extremely hard as a choreographer to create dances that people can easily relate to, even if they are centered on uplifting trans and queer lives and stories.
Yeah, and on that point, where do you draw your inspiration from?
My creative process is extremely long. I normally take between 2 to 3 years to make a full evening work. And the magic, the sources of the inspiration are many. Here at home, I'm so blessed to be deeply in love with my partner of almost 23 years, another amazing trans artist, Shauna Virago, who is a bit of a rock star, singer-songwriter, just named by Billboard as top 50 albums of the year. And by my community, you know, starting first with what I call my trans sisters. So I'm definitely a bit of a history nerd and love to geek out on learning about, digging around to learn about my trans sisters. And my creative process always involves working directly with folks in my community.
And for people who haven't been to any of your shows, can you just describe what people can expect to see?
So, Chandra Dance, we will often talk about our work as being dance theater. My sound scores always include not only original music that I commission from amazing composers, gorgeous music, but I'm also a writer. And so my own writing, narration, poetry is featured in the sound scores. And in the case of our 20th anniversary season, we are extraordinarily excited to be sharing and restaging works from over the last 20 years. And so, for example, some of these excerpts feature audiences will hear the actual voices and stories recorded in oral history interviews. And so folks are going to hear these remarkable stories as part of the sound score. So that's why I talk about it as dance theater, is it's really rooted in human story.
And let's talk a little bit about the political climate right now. Now we're seeing a surge in anti-trans legislation in many states across the country. And I'm wondering how the cultural climate has changed in the 20 years since you've been an activist for trans people.
So I will start off by saying something I often say, which is that I love being transgender. Mm-hmm. I love being trans. I give thanks to the universe every day that I'm trans. And yes, in this moment, we are seeing the worst national, statewide, and regional anti-trans organizing that we've seen in a very, very many years. This year alone, there are over 600 active bills that are targeted and specifically designed to take away trans people's rights, our rights to access schools and education safely, our rights to access the healthcare we need to stay healthy. So we are in a moment of a massive backlash. You know, we're very blessed to tour a lot. We've toured to more than 35 cities across the country and around the world. And there are cities that I won't tour to now that I was happy to tour to 20 years ago. We toured throughout Texas and Florida and all kinds of states that would literally be unsafe for us to visit now. Our entire company is either trans, non-binary, two-spirit, everyone's queer. So it is really intense to reckon with the fact that it is more dangerous for us to tour now as an openly trans and queer company than it was 20 years ago. Now, that being said, I will also share with listeners that there is also more love and support and understanding for trans communities than ever before. So we have these really intense violent forces, but there are also amazing activists, incredible artists and artist collectives and all kinds of non-trans or cisgender allies across education, healthcare, all kinds of fields, the arts. We're really calling on folks who aren't trans to really, you know, step up and support in this moment. I'm proud that Sean Dorsey Dance has absolutely been a huge force in transforming the landscape, not just in the Bay Area, but across the country through our work. You know, we've totally transformed audiences for modern dance. We've brought completely new content to modern dance. And we've left a swath of changes, not only in hearts and minds as we've toured cities, but also actual tangible physical changes. So my technical writer requires theaters to make their lobby bathrooms and backstage bathrooms all gender. And so we've seen a swath of major theaters all across the U.S. converting their bathrooms to be all gender in support of future artists and future audiences. So there's been tangible, you know, lasting change, as well as obviously in the hearts of minds of folks that we touch.
So you're not only promoting cultural mindset changes, but actual physical changes to our built environment. So
it's absolutely
very, very impressive. Well, I mentioned that it's the 20th anniversary of the Sean Dorsey Dance Company. Can you talk about the piece that you're performing to celebrate this milestone?
Yeah, so this is really a treat for us and especially for our audiences. This is the first time in our 20 years that we've ever restaged and brought back audience favorites. And so the pieces we're performing are from a trilogy of works that I created over the course of about a decade. And these were all shows that revealed and uplifted parts of previously censored or buried parts of trans and queer history. One of these works is The Secret History of Love. So as a longtime activist, I know a fair amount about our history of resistance and struggle and riots and fighting for change. But I also was curious, I wanted to know, what about our love? And so I had the exquisite opportunity to travel across the country and record oral history with LGBTQI plus elders, asking them, tell me about your first crush. Tell me how you met folks. Tell me about these underground clubs and speakeasies when it was illegal to dance together, and just the most both heart-wrenching and hilarious, sassy, you know, just the full range of human experience. Also, The Missing Generation is a show that I created after recording oral history conversations with folks who were longtime survivors from the early part of the AIDS epidemic. And so we're performing excerpts of these two works, and then we're performing the full piece of a show that is very, very close to my heart called Lou. And Lou is a piece which is based on the lifelong diaries of this trailblazing trans activist called Lou Sullivan. Lou Sullivan lived and died before the internet, which is why many, many folks, even the hippest young trans activists on the cutting edge, often haven't heard of him. And so I'm a little bit religious about proselytizing and spreading the word of Lou Sullivan. Trailblazing activist, lived right here in the Bay Area. And when he knew he was passing from AIDS complications in the early part of the AIDS epidemic, he worked tirelessly to organize his lifelong papers and diaries and bequeath them to the GLBT Historical Society. I spent a year poring over these incredible diaries. This work features my own writing, bookending a series of me reading excerpts from his remarkable journey, these diary entries. It is, I will say, an exquisite dance. It's incredibly powerful. I'm so proud to bring it back.
And so for listeners who want to see this in action or just see one of your performances, where are you performing next and how can listeners get tickets?
Thank you. Yes. So our 20th Sean Dorsey Dance's 20th anniversary season is right here in the Bay. It's September 19 through 21 at Z Space Theater in San Francisco. Info and tickets are at SeanDorseyDance.com, SeanDorsey.com. So check out our website and get to know us.
All right. Well, Sean, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. And for listeners, if you want more information about Sean and his work, you can go to SeanDorseyDance.com to get more information. And Sean, we wish you wonderful success and congratulations with your 20th anniversary and the shows coming up. And thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much, Ethan. Thank you.
And you just heard a piece of an original song called Electricity at the beginning of that interview I just had with Sean Dorsey. The music was composed by Storm Miguel, featuring Dorsey's oral history interviews with queer and trans elders. And we've also got resources on our website, on our State of the Bay page on KALW.org with some of the topics we discussed tonight. So check out that page for more information. And that's State of the Bay this week. We're off next week for the Labor Day holiday, but we hope you'll join us our following show on Monday, the 9th, September 9th at 6 o'clock. I want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Katie Colley. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.